Hey folks, Sam Jones here, and welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor, musician, writer, director, and poker player, Don Cheadle. Don is hands down one of the most gifted actors working today. Look at just a fraction of his work, like Hotel Rwanda, Traffic, and House of Lies, and you realize how few artists can embody such a range of characters with such authenticity, and seemingly with such little effort. Don recently added some credits to his resume when he took on writing and directing Miles Ahead, the experimental film about jazz trumpeter Miles Davis, which you better not call a biopic. He also appears in almost every frame of Miles Ahead. At times, the experience left him curled up in a quivering ball, and at others, filled with the joy of seeing a vision come to life. It's a vision he knows will rub some people the wrong way, but as his friend Herbie Hancock told him, that's what makes art stick with you. One thing's certain, it's made a lot of people rethink what films about real-life characters can be. It's already made many in the industry realize that Don's creative talents go way beyond acting. Like many of our guests, Don planned to be an actor from a pretty young age. Unlike a lot of them, he did have a fallback plan, being a musician. Clearly, he's not risk-averse. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about an important career question he thinks every parent should be ready to ask their kids. Speaking of careers, Don has some straight talk for all you aspiring actors out there. Though he's been doing amazing work for the last three decades, I left our conversation feeling like his most impressive contributions are still ahead of him. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Don, how you doing?
Good, man.
Thanks for coming and doing this. Let's start with a water break.
Yeah, let's do that first. Get hydrated. I want to get the tears ready.
Get them ready. Yeah, get your tear ducts all lubricated.
Tear ducts all lubed up.
So let's talk about your mother. No.
Exactly. Boom.
You know, we've been in social circles before, but we haven't really ever sat down and had a long conversation. But I wanted to, as a way to end this conversation, relate a visual I have of you, which is we were at a wedding, and somehow you sort of organized a poker game, like a serious poker game at the wedding.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And I think my wife sat at the table for a while. I was like, yeah, I looked over, and you're at the table, and you're shuffling cards like you're a dealer in Vegas. You know what I mean? Like the perfect bridge and the fast.
Youth.
And you're not even looking. You know? And I watched from the doorway for a few minutes, and I go, God, that dude looks like a serious poker player. And then it also hit me. Like, I started thinking about some of the characters you've played, and I thought, I bet no one at the table ever knows what you're holding. Like, you just seem to have this gravity that seems like it would, for poker, it would work really well.
Would that were true. I'm in the rears. I'm in arrears.
You're not in the rears.
I'm in the rear. I'm in arrears.
Not that kind of show.
Poker, right? Yeah, I should be better as much time as I've spent. And it depends. It's sort of like, it depends on when you ask that question. Sometimes I'm a very good poker player, and sometimes I'm a very bad poker player.
What is the thing that makes a good poker player if you take chance out of it and you just look at, you know, if no one's on a lucky streak or something, is it confidence? Is it?
There's a lot of math involved. That's the biggest thing. The biggest thing is understanding how to deal with the odds,
yeah,
the hand strength, have a good memory about how this person has played, and the psychology of not just what is he doing, but what does he think I'm doing?
Right, right.
What do I think he thinks I think? You know what I mean? It's like that kind of surveying the land is what makes really good poker players. And then just being anymore, these guys are just fearless. They're just super aggressive and are not afraid of, you know, betting five times into a pot if they think they can bet a person off the hand. It doesn't matter what they have.
So have you been in that situation where you have absolute shit in your hands and you'll just...
Yeah, you have to do that. If you're not doing that at some points during the game, you're just waiting around for great cards, and those only come once every 40 hands. So if you're not doing that, you're not really playing poker.
Well, I would think that relates to an actor that comes in and commits to an audition, mm-hmm. commits to something, even if it's for that 5 minutes.
Yep.
And I would think there'd be some relationship there to how thick your armor is or how much you develop that confidence. I mean, is that something that you early on looked at? What does that look like to you when you're coming up?
No, I think really that's something that I've just recently, I mean, within the last several years, come to terms with. The, it's not fearless, because there's still trepidation, I'm still anxious about it, but not giving that anxiousness or that fear or that trepidation enough strength and enough power that you won't do the thing anyway.
All
you
right.
know what I mean? It's like it's kind of what they're saying, that bravery is not the absence of fear, but it's the presence of fear, but doing it anyway. And that's kind of what I've learned. You know, like I said, it's very late in life for me to have learned that, where I would see other people around me, I'm like, how do you do that? It's like, they're fearless. It's like, no, they just can deal with the consequence. They can just deal with what happens afterwards. And if you can deal with what happens afterwards, and what you realize is mostly what it might be is embarrassment.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you can deal with being embarrassed or deal with, like, failing and didn't do that right, then you can do many more things. But
yeah.
That's been something that was kind of late for me, I think, that I was a late bloomer on that one.
Were you in an environment where there was teasing or bullying, or were you, was it a pretty safe place?
I think I was really lucky that, as far as acting goes, that I got positive reactions very early. You know, it was something that at 10 years old, when I was in Charlotte's Web as Templeton the Rat, on stage performing in the last number, and people were clapping and stood up, I was like, oh, shit. This is pretty cool. You know what I mean? So very early, I got this confidence that this was some place that I could try stuff and I could have fun and disappear in a character and all that stuff. Outside of that, you know, in my personal life with friends and stuff, I mean, in my real life, I think I was much less of a risk taker.
Really?
That's the place I would take the risk.
Did you ever sort of test things you learned as an actor and see if they work in real life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're always trying to, like, get over on stuff. And it was fun to try to play characters in the real world and see if you would get busted or not, you know.
What's an example of that?
I don't know. Just telling a story, just making up a set of circumstances, you know, being in a conversation, meeting a stranger, and just lying, basically. But just not lying just for the sake of some, you know, there's some goal at the end of it, like, if I lie, I can beat him out of this. But
right.
just trying to see if you could make them believe this history that you had fabricated as if you were in a scene. And my friends and I always also used to, like, we love to, like, fake fight. So we get into, like, fake fights outside of stuff and, oh, grab ketchup and I'm going to hit you and you spit the ketchup all over the window and do stupid, silly, you know, silly shit like that. But, it was a great learning tool that, like I said, much later I realized that kind of confidence and that kind of willingness to just step out and maybe not, maybe fall flat on your face is something that you really need to incorporate in your life and taking chances and putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. And that's where you start to learn, and that's how you start to grow, and that's how you start to, you know, expand your experience.
Yeah. I don't know where I read, but I read some story about you at a very young age breaking down a script without knowing what you were doing. But it struck me when I read that you might have known enough about what you wanted to do to take it seriously enough to develop. Like, did you develop a system pretty early on for this is how I do things?
You know, I think it was that was about actually the Templeton the Rat. That was actually
when
I was in fifth grade doing Charlotte's Web. I remember that I took that script to a little cafe that was up the street from my house, and I was, you know, highlighting my lines, but also trying to think about my motivation. Like, why did he say that? And why would he say that? And what does a rat think in this situation? And I didn't know why I was doing that. I don't know why I was thinking that. I hadn't been taught formally anything about script analysis. But I was really trying to get into the mindset of a rat. And, you know, I wanted to read the book and make sure I understood what Templeton was and see the movie. It was all the, you know, I just wanted to do really well as Templeton.
Where do you think that comes from? Like, were your parents analytical people that would, that you think there was that example, that that's how you tackle a project?
I think the examples were being put in front of me by my dad's a psychologist, and, you know, my mother was an educator, and all of that, you know, sort of, as you talk about, analytical way of thinking about things and examining motivations and why would you say a certain thing and what was going on in your head when this or that happened. I mean, people used to ask me all the time, did your dad psychoanalyze you all the time? I was like, right. I don't think so. But I only have one dad, so I can't compare it to other dads. I don't know. But I know that we would talk a lot about things, and we were always allowed to question. You know, it wasn't ever, you do what I say and that's it. It was, we were allowed to go, what, why? You know, and we could have a talk about it. At the end of it, you were still doing what he said, but you could have a conversation. It wasn't just like, because I said so. And maybe there was something there that's about what's why. Maybe asking why was something that was just
why
part of what
Templeton
I got to do.
So ornery?
Yeah, why is he such a glut?
Yeah.
What is the gluttony about? Where does that come from? Are all rats gluttons? Is that's what it is?
But that's exactly what you have to do. That's the work you have to do, right? Like, you have to know sort of a backstory or no. Because, I don't know, in having a lot of these conversations, one thing that struck me is that you never want to know the future, but you want to know as much about your own past as you can.
Yeah.
Right? So that something can become instinctual.
Well, yeah, you want to be, and it depends. It's like the theater's different, obviously, than if you're playing a character over and over and over, and you get to sort of groove this person that you're going to be for 6, 8, 12, 15 weeks, however long you're doing a play. There's a different kind of a malleable nature of that after a while. You know, you lock something in, then you let it go, then you find new ways to do it, and something else gets, you know, you get stuck in some place, and there's an area where it's really free, and then you're like, why can't I find that freedom here in this moment there? And then that opens up, and then something else locks up. You know, it's this kind of living thing inside of the set parameters of a play. TV's a little is different. It's faster, you know what I mean? You're the same character, but every week it's a different thing that you're dealing with. And movies are a different thing entirely, too. But I guess for all acting to be something that we believe, it has to look spontaneous. It has to seem as if, like you're saying, I don't know what's happened. I don't know what's about to happen. I'm not end-gaming this. I'm just in the moment, alive right here. And I guess that's the challenge that all actors have to try to be moment to moment. And I guess in life, that's when you're doing life the best, too, is when you're able to just kind of be in the moment.
I totally agree. And I think you can go through cycles, because when you start getting some success, or at least for me, I start looking at what did I do to get that success?
Yeah.
But then you can become a slave to your process too, right?
Yeah.
You can say, oh, I have to do it this way. And if I don't, then I'm slacking off. I mean, have you gone through periods where you've had to actually examine the process and say, do I really need to do this? Or,
well, it's so funny because it reminds me of this, I'm going to probably ruin it, but this old vaudeville story about this vaudeville veteran actor and this young guy, and the veteran actor is the straight guy and the young guy is the funny man. He's got the jokes in this one, and he's crushing, and he keeps killing, and there's some joke that they're doing, and every time he says his punchline, the audience dies laughing, and it starts kind of not working, and then it's not working, and over, it's not working. And in the thing, he's supposed to, you know, ask for the coffee. And when he asks for the coffee, everybody cracks up, and it's not working anymore. And he says to the veteran one night, why isn't this working anymore? He goes, you're asking for the laugh. Ask for the coffee.
Ah.
You know, it's like you're locked into this result now. You know, you're trying to get the results. It's like just live in the moment. The joke works.
Right.
But you got to do what the joke needs. You got to not ask for people to laugh at you. You got to ask for the coffee. And that's what you have to remind yourself of all the time, is not to end game it and to go, I just have to be in this scene and be in this moment, and the result will take care of itself. So I guess if you're going to draw an analogy to your career or how you approach your work, I think people can smell when you're making cynical decisions, or when you're making craven decisions, or when you're trying to sort of outthink and be strategic. It's like, I think that gives off it's off-putting. as opposed to authentically going, oh, I want to do this because I like this and I'm interested in this and I want to dig into this and get into it. People don't want to feel like you're watching them watch you.
It brings up a question about audience. Like, you know, if you, does your audience see you like you see yourself? Do you ever think about that? Do you ever think, are they seeing something completely different than what you're putting out?
Absolutely. And there's countless times that I've been in a movie and I've been in a screening and they'll react differently to something that you intended, or they'll won't react to something. You're like, you didn't get that that was, or they laugh and you're like, I wasn't trying to be funny there, or they take something serious. And you're like, I was trying to be, you know, it's just, it's its own thing.
Yeah.
And it's as much about how, what the audience comes in with as it is about what you're, you know, putting into that. And so to try and kind of figure all of that stuff out, I think is really not your job. And you can't really do it anyway. People decide what it is. You don't get that. You don't get the right to do that after
right.
that. All I can do is take care of my own work and what I'm trying to achieve in this moment, in this thing.
Does it take getting work to develop as an actor?
Well, I think a lot of times people think that you have to have a job to work on acting, which you don't. You know what I mean? I've read a lot of plays, and you can obviously work on monologues. You can always work on script analysis. You can always, you know, you can very often read scenes with people that you don't have to be performing for people. That's all a part of the work to me. You're still working on your instrument, and you're still keeping your chops up when you're doing that stuff. Whether or not you're performing for people or there's an audience doesn't mean that you can't work, you know? So yes, in application, it often takes someone else, a partner, to be able to actually do the thing that you're doing. But I think a lot of people, I know people come up to me and say, you know, hey man, I want to do what you, I want to be an actor, and I'm like, how can I be an actor? And I go, do you want to be an actor or do you want to be a star or a celebrity? Or like, well, I'm like, are you acting right now? Are you in anything? Are you in plays? Are you auditioning for plays? Do you read plays? Are you reading scripts? Do you go to Sam French and grab stuff and see what you can work on? I'm like, that's all working. That's all doing acting work. Now, you know, yes, maybe you're not on a TV show or somebody hasn't put you in a film, but if you think that's the only way acting happens, it's probably going to be one or two things are going to happen. You're never going to get that shot, or you're going to get that shot and you're not going to be ready, or you're going to get that shot and you're going to get that shot, and then very quickly they're going to see that you're this deep and you have nothing to bring to the game.
When you were coming up, did you do all those things? Did you, like, how did you fill your time when you weren't working?
I was very fortunate because I had good teachers, you know what I mean? I had good examples very early. And even my you know, Barbara Althaus in Home Elementary School that, you know, directed the Charlotte's Web production that I was in was, you know, would talk about work. Not in that, you know, we were 10 and 11 years old, so it wasn't about go read Uta Hagen and you should study Stanislavski, but it was...
Write me 20 pages on the Siegel by
exactly
tomorrow.
Exactly right. Why did Chekhov reduce that one line to... No, it wasn't like that, but she was talking about the way you think about your character, and well, why would Templeton do that here? Or what do you think Wilbur would say that, you know, and... made you, it turned on that part of your brain that wasn't just like, go stand there, make sure that you turn out when you sing that song because the audience needs to see your face. There was that too, because we were 10, but she would ask the other questions about, well, what's going on? Why are they having that conversation? What are they thinking about? Which is just a simple question, but it's kind of the same question that you would ask at this level for any actor in any scene. You would go, what's going on here? What's the text? What's the subtext? All of those things, for me, started really early. And then I got to high school, and my high school teacher was a very, you know, well-trained theater teacher and introduced us to Uta Hagen and Stanislavski and the ways to...
In high school, that's
in
amazing.
High school. And then when I graduated from high school, I went to Cal Arts. So there was, for me, a continuum that started very early about acting, and it wasn't any of it wasn't, I mean, in the back of my head, of course, you're watching TV and you're watching movies and go, oh, maybe I can do that there at some point.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about, that's what you're trying to do. It wasn't about, make sure you get on TV. It was about, make sure you know what you're doing. What's this about? What's acting about? and then apply it wherever you can apply it. But you got to know what this is first.
Did you love the work as much as the... You did.
I did. I still do. I mean, I still read monologues and read scenes with my kids sometimes for fun. And I mean, my wife and I will read scenes together. And we're always she's always reading my work with me, and I write stuff and we read it together. But I still get excited about getting a good script and closing everything off and closing everybody out and just going through it and reading it.
Did it dawn on you at one point that you just knew this is what you wanted to do? I mean, were you young, and did you have another plan? Like, well, if this doesn't work out,
I'll be a musician. That was the fallback.
So was there a point where you were conflicted? Because I think when people are talented in multiple areas of the arts, it can be harder because you get so much joy out of different places, right? I'm sure you got a huge amount of joy out of music.
More than acting ever.
More than acting.
Yeah.
So how do you make that decision, and how do you stick with it when times get hard?
I don't remember making any sort of declaration, and I know that that music and theater, I was doing both, you know, and playing jazz bands and playing in bands that were, you know, citywide bands made up of people around the city, and then our own bands that we would go and perform at parties and stuff and make money on the side. And I was doing that at the same time. I was in all the school plays and doing theater and doing citywide theater, that, you know, kind of on two tracks.
Right. Which you can be as a kid. You don't have to make a decision.
Yeah, I didn't. And it was all good in high school. And when I graduated from high school, I had a couple of small scholarships to pursue acting, and I had a couple of small scholarships to pursue vocal jazz and music.
So that point, you sort of have to make a decision because you're choosing which school is going to be better.
Yeah, where am I tracking now? For
right.
Real? But I also had come up with some pretty, like, serious musicians. Ron Miles, Javon Jackson, Brad Lely, these guys who are, like, professionals now and doing it now and recording artists now. And I saw the amount of work that was necessary to get there. And I also had a good enough ear and understanding of the music to know what I wanted for myself if I was going to do it. Because I was listening to Cannonball Adderley and Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and Coltrane. I mean, that was like, that's the trajectory. I want to try, who doesn't? But I was like, that's kind of where I want to be headed.
Yeah.
And I know the amount of theory I'm going to have to learn and the amount of practice I'm going to have to put in and the kind of time that would require. And I still might not get there. And I just went, I don't think that's a mountain that I can climb right now.
Now, did you have the same side about acting? Like, if I'm going to do this, I want to be on that level of the greats. Like, you just mentioned the greatest jazz people of all.
Right.
Yeah. Are you looking at
Brando?
And saying
Morgan Freeman and Denzel.
Is this who I want to be?
I thought that was somewhat more within my grasp than the other, than ever being able to play like Coltrane.
Did you talk to your parents? Did you sit down with your dad and say, you know, and you had sort of the scholarship offers? And
yeah.
You did?
Yeah, to both of them.
You remember their advice?
What do you want to do?
They kept it really simple.
Yeah, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? This is ultimately going to be what you want to do. And I think they were loath to be parents who were like, no, you need to do this, and then have me have a miserable time doing that. And they may have had conversations in the bedroom that, you know, they're like, holy shit.
Actor or musician.
Actor or musician? You know, he's not going to get it. Neither of those are going to work out.
Well, that's got to be the thought of any parent, no matter how good your kid may be or his teachers are saying he is. You know, that's a small sample size.
Yeah, that's a small target to hit.
But it also brings up, you know, when you're a kid, things look so hard and so big. And so, you know, I think of you saying, I didn't think I could be good enough to be a musician. But now...
Now I know it.
Now you know it. So there's never a thought of, like, I could have done this. Maybe I shortchanged myself at that time.
There are times when I'm playing trumpet, bass, piano, whatever, that I go, wow, if I had then, now I would. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's also an understanding, and I can't tell myself the story anymore. I'm 51 years old. I know that, well, do it now. I know that there's no impediment to me doing it.
Right.
So there's, I don't have that thing riding on my shoulder anymore. It's like that doesn't hold water. If you want that, you do it now and you get as good as you get. You know, not everybody wants to play like Keith Jarrett. So you probably won't be able to, or maybe you will. Who knows? But I know that you won't by sitting here going, "Man, I wish I could." We'll start playing. Then you might get there. You know. So that's what's sort of liberating for me now is I don't have that same knot in my stomach about it, or that same sort of trepidation about, God, but if I can't get there, I can't. It's like, yeah, that's a reality. You probably can't get there. You know, John Coltrane started playing when he was 10 or 11 years old. May not get there.
Well, you picked also a genre of music that it would be like trying to be first chair in the New York Philharmonic or something.
Yeah, good luck.
Violin.
That's not what the music at 17, what that meant to me is not the same thing it means to me at 51 years old. You know, I enjoy it and I get off on the ability to communicate with a bunch of other people in a non-verbal way that is just, unless you play it, it's very hard to explain. If you play music, you know.
That's right.
That turns on something else in your head that nothing else turns on. It speaks to some part of you that nothing else that I've done anyway even comes close to touching. You go in a room with in everybody, you don't know anybody's backstory, you don't know anything about anybody else. If you do that, you know, and then you all can come together and talk about something, like you all learned a language that no one taught you guys all collectively, but you're all collectively talking on the same level and changing the conversation as you're going, and it's just its own thing.
It is. You know, I'm curious about having to go deep into playing the trumpet for this film Miles Ahead that I want to get to and talk about. If having a goal in your practicing rather than just playing music, but a certain goal and a deadline, if that changed your relationship to music.
It allowed me to sort of revisit some muscles that I hadn't, you know, flexed or used in a while. Trumpet, there's just a physical, just the actual physical nature of having to get your embouchure together and play a horn, and the breath and the musculature and all of that stuff was new stuff. I was that kid that would come home and put on an LP of Cannonball Adderley, let's say. And that's when there was an LP, and there were 33 and 78.
Sure.
So you could play the 33 at 78, and it was almost an octave lower.
Uh-huh.
Not exactly, but almost. So I could hear it because it was slower. I could hear it, but so it would be. So I could actually stop it, put the needle back, stop, put the needle back, put the needle back, and I would do that through the whole solo until I could transcribe the whole solo.
Wow.
And figure out, like, oh, that's what he was playing. Oh, that. And I was doing that with the Miles stuff. On this movie, I would, you know, listen to a solo on Miles Ahead and not just go get the sheet music, but I'd sit in my room and...
Gosh, I'm interested in what happens when you do that work, how it unconsciously informs your acting and getting into that character, too. Was there ever a moment on this film where you were able to just sort of relax into the confidence of knowing that you'd gone deep enough into the man's music to actually understand more about him?
No.
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 I never.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because Miles Ahead is this film that, tell me briefly, just so people catch up, how long you've been involved in this project and how long it took to get to this place where it's about, you know, it's here.
Well, I would say as early as 2004, I don't know exactly when it started, kind of the whisperings of...
Like 12 years of...
From people that had played with Miles that I would bump into somewhere in some situation, M2MA, going, hey, you'd be a good Miles. You should think about that. Or Quincy Troupe somewhere that I'd see him in some place, and you go, you know, I wrote this autobiography and I'm doing this thing. I'd be like, oh, that, you know. they would just the rumblings of it were coming around. As always, I would go, well, okay, well, if there's anything that comes together, let me know.
Yeah.
I wasn't really that interested in doing another biopic at that point. You know, I had done the Sammy Davis thing. I'd done Go HBO. I'd done, you know, Hotel Rwanda was right at around that time.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, for whatever reason, good with playing historical characters. I was like, I'd like to just, you know, play someone close to me maybe and do something, you know, be a modern person, not have to set myself back 40 years to get a good story. Right. Are there any modern stories about black people that live today that might actually be good to do? I want to do one of those, you know. So Miles was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, and they were interviewing his nephew, Vince Wilburn, who played with them. And they asked Vince if there was ever going to be a movie about his life. And he said, yeah, Don Cheadle's going to play him.
So, on TV.
Yeah. So it had been announced at that point.
You get a call from your agent. Why haven't I heard about that?
Pretty much.
It's a fascinating strategy, though, for how to get a project going.
It's
happening.
You just have to kind of force them into existence.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like by polite, you know, and permission. You have to just go, this is happening. So Vince went, this is happening. He's playing him. So then people started calling, and I met with the family, and they pitched me some of the ideas, which all...
Were they biopic-esque?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I kind of am not into that, especially with this guy. I mean, this dude is one of the most creative artists of all time.
Across any genre.
Across any genre. Yeah. And changed music 4 times and touched everything and lived a wild life. You know, I'm like, I want to make a movie that I think Miles Davis would want to be the star of. I don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to be like, I kept saying, I want to do Don Cheadle is Miles Davis as Miles Davis in whatever.
Well, and the film has that quality to it. What struck me so much about seeing the film is how much his particular life philosophy towards music influenced the script and the film.
Yeah.
And it couldn't be further from a biopic.
It could.
I mean, it's a new form of film in a lot of ways. I mean, I was blown away when I saw the film its relationship to some of the most, you know, creative jazz minds that have ever lived. Like, I think the relationships to this film are not other directors and other films. They're records. And there's psychology in there, I feel like. The way we have memories and how our memories are influenced by emotion, how time stretches, and maybe a heavier emotional memory will get put into another place because it makes more sense in our brain next to the resolution of that thing, even if the resolution was 3 years later or 5 years later. And
could you just tour around me and have this conversation every time? But I mean, but you were touching on all of the stuff that when we finally got into this iteration of the film with the irrational financier who finally said, all right, I'll pay for it. And we tried to cobble this whole thing together. Steven Begelman, who co-wrote the script with me, these were the conversations that we would have all the time and pull back and go, is that too esoteric? Is this too heady?
Well, clearly
are we trying to do something that's not? Well, we always talked ourselves down off of that ledge and went, no, it isn't.
Yeah.
No, it isn't. Is this too arch? It's like, no, it isn't. Do we have to talk about when he met Dizzy and Coltrane and Cannonball and when he left Juilliard and went to the street and then he left that and then he went and started working with the Guild? And do we have to talk about modality versus bebop and the bebop? It's like, no, but we had to keep asking that question because that's the weight of the gravitational pull of biopics and the gravitational pull of how you are supposed to deal with an historical figure and what you need to do is so strong that you're kind of looking at each other going, I know we say we want to violate this, and that was our interest in this from the beginning, and that's what made us the most excited about this. But are we really going to do that?
Yeah.
And by the way, stuff that Steven and I love, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't stuff that we were like, yeah, it doesn't matter. It's like, I love that story. I would love to figure out, but we would always say, but does it track? Does it track with the story that we're trying to tell about somebody who basically has writer's block? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. So talk about the moment when it struck you that the architecture of this film should be built around this period where he not only didn't put any records out, but he stopped playing altogether. You know, there's a passing line in the beginning of the film. He really is the Howard Hughes of jazz.
And
he disappeared off the map.
Right.
And I wonder if you could sort of talk me through the feeling when you settled on that, like when an artist gets the key that unlocks the entire thing.
It was. And even you just saying it again, to me, when I hear it, sounds like something. Again, it's like this prolific, one of the most prolific artists who went from bebop and left the comfort of that, left the hug of Charlie Parker and Dizzy and all the fame that you could want playing with the greatest guys who'd ever done it.
Just,
I'm done with that. Now I'm going to do this. And getting complete success in that milieu and doing something, oh, the birth of the cool, what's all that? And the new, and now I'm going to do this. It's like, and when you hear his solos, you hear him play some of the most beautiful ballads and the last note will ring out and he's like, I played it back, oh, I hit it back. There's no reverie, he doesn't sit in it, you know, he doesn't luxuriate in the feeling that he just created for everybody. He's like, okay, I played that, what's the next thing? How does somebody who's like that stop? What happens when that just stops? And how does it stop? And why does it stop? And how does it get going again once it stops? All of those questions to me were more interesting and exciting than how, when he met John Coltrane and they had a fight backstage because John was on the nod and he's like, don't fucking do that to the music, and they got in a fist fight. That's a cool scene and that's an interesting moment.
Yeah.
And it does speak to Miles' dedication to the music. But I understand that better just kind of at first blush than I do this other part. So that to me says that's something, there's more there.
It's interesting that you chose that because I think every artist that does something into the crossover commercial world, Miles sold records, you make films, there's an economic expectation to it all. Whenever you have that, I think there's also a tendency to try to stick people in their lane. And I'm sure you've had this as an actor, right? I mean, even from the straight biopic, Don's going to play
him. That's what I'm saying. That's why I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that.
And here you have this artist that every single time someone stuck him in a lane, he would go, I'm going over here.
Yeah.
So to me, just that idea that you chose to do that, it says a lot about you.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of points of connectivity that I felt with that, is with Miles.
Well, two things strike me about Miles that I want to throw out. Number one is the oft-told story about him, that the idea that if he heard you in your hotel room practicing and you played that same solo that night on stage,
done.
He wanted you to discover something. And
he wanted
the audience to be part of that discovery. And the other thing, people always describe his sound and his decisions in his compositions as leaving room for the listener to finish the solo.
Right.
And I couldn't help but think, how do you apply those two constructs to a film when a film has to have so much
preparation
and organization
is
set.
Yeah.
But how do you leave room?
You're right. A film, a production has to be highly organized and to the degree that you can, every potential trap down the road avoided, figured out how you can manage this army as you're trying to get through this process. But within
can't
that...
Can't tell the DP, like, well, I might be over there and I might be over there.
Exactly.
See,
just kind of light general enough, we'll figure it out. But you try to ask where is the freedom within this framework?
Yeah.
Where is the freedom within this shot? And not just from the DP, but from your sound guy, from the designer, from your set decorator, to everybody, I brought them in early and said, I want to cast you, I want to hire you in the same way that Miles would pick a musician. He didn't tell John Coltrane what to play. He said, you can play, so play. The best directors I've worked with have that. One of my favorite stories is being on the set of Traffic and Steven Soderbergh and his first AD, who he's worked with forever, Greg, were talking about a scene that they had to do, and Steven was saying, okay, on this scene, I was in another scene, another actor, his name is Kiki, he said, I want Don and Kiki to walk by having this conversation, and I want you to have, you know, extras passing back and forth in the foreground. And Greg said, you want Don and Kiki in the foreground, and you want the extras passing by in the background. And he said, no, I want Don and Kiki in the background, and I want the extras passing in front of them in the foreground. And Greg said, you want Don and Kiki in the foreground, and you want the extras in the background. And Steven looked at him like, are you... And then he kind of looked off, and he went, yeah, I want Don and Kiki in the foreground. I want the extras working in the background. He said, okay. And he walked up to make it happen. And there was no, you know what I mean? It was like, because at the end of the day, he wants the best film. And if you keep that in front of you, then you're going to do things like that a lot.
Yeah.
And why put somebody in that job and then try to micromanage him? You do have to be the final say, and you're the final arbiter of what this is, this whole thing is that you want it to be. But within that, for me, it was necessary for me to do it in the seat I was in all the seats I was in.
Because you were in every frame of the film.
Yeah, I had to offload that stuff to people, and I wanted to. And I wanted them to feel ownership about the project because we were all playing this together. We were all in the band, you know.
That brings up a great topic about first time directing, because this film not only had been on your radar and you're like Sisyphus pushing this rock up the hill for a decade, but it was also the closest thing to your heart musically and everything. Like when you talk about the film in a director's career where it's like, that's the one, that's me, you know, having that as your first one, like it would be nice to, I don't know, be able to
have
practice
to
on a low-budget slasher film
right,
or something,
exactly.
You know, where you can just learn your craft and you don't really care about the subject matter so much or having to be so true to somebody that's so up here as an artist.
Yeah.
And I just wonder on that first day if somehow I could get in your shoes and understand how much you thought you'd prepared and then you got there and saw how much you weren't prepared. How was that?
It was terror.
Terror.
Terror from day one. I mean, before day one. Actually, before day one, I could tell myself that, you know, hey, but a meteor might hit and we might all die and I may never have to do this and it won't be my fault. I can just go, oh.
And you're hoping for that at a certain point.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe the apocalypse happens and I don't have to do this.
I mean, did you sort of in your head map out, like, did you look at a room and say, okay, so I'm in costume, I'm Miles, I'm doing this thing. And then I'm going to have to go walk over and talk to the... Were you able to simulate how that experience was going to be?
In my head, yeah. I had all these ideas about what it would be like and how I would have to be able to do it. And, of course, all that shit goes out the window the first moment you're on the set.
So what were you
and
like
the real world
trying
comes
to figure
in.
That out?
Well, you know, the first day on set was the day that we are driving to Columbia.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So...
process trailer and the...
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
No process trailer. Didn't quite have that kind of a budget. It was, you know, indie cars, you know, period cars, which I think we had 9 of or something like that.
Total.
Total.
Indie driving
bus.
Around
yeah, absolutely. All of that. Can they drive this way really close to the camera one time so they're out of focus and then in focus that, you know, one way we only have one way we can control, only control the street this way?
Do we have control of the street this way?
Okay. That's what it was every day. Do we have that? And I think in a good way, the pressure and the having to make, you know, decisions that were had huge implications.
Like that. Yeah.
Something about that pressure, although it wasn't good for my health and I lost weight and almost had a breakdown, it was terrifying and all of that stuff.
Well, that bad.
It was really, 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 really hard. Like Bridget, who, you know, came back after I came back, my wife, she was like, I don't think you can, you can't do that anymore. I was like, well, I don't know. She's like, no, you cannot do another movie like that. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You were not healthy. You didn't look good. It was not good for
you. Gave all for that.
Yeah, there was no other way to do it. I mean, I tried to give this movie away. I didn't want to if it had all gone away several years ago, I would have been relieved. I would have felt like, well, good.
That's how it is when you love something so much, almost. You don't want to. You don't want to be the guy who screwed
yeah,
it up.
Yeah, who messes it up? You know, I didn't, and I really thought that it would. And I would kind of say still today, at the end of it, I don't know that it's the smartest thing to do all of those things. I don't think you necessarily have. You definitely don't have the ability to be as granular as you need to be as an actor for your particular performance in the role that you're doing, just you, and also have the 10,000-foot perspective that you have to have as a director to manage the entire thing. You're porpoising the whole time. I was the whole time.
It's funny you say that, because watching the film, if you didn't know that you directed it, I would assume, oh my God, that might have been a tough set, because I bet he never came out of character, right. And I bet there was so much energy needed for the actor that, you know, the whole crew had to make allowances for that thing. But that's the performance came off like that. I mean, I think you are in every frame of the film. But to me, I felt like you disappeared inside Miles Davis completely. I don't know how you direct and do that.
I couldn't do it all the time, but as much as I could do it, I would do it. And some days I'd show up on set and I would just tell my producer, like, you're fucking with Miles today. Like, today, don't even talk to Don. Don't even say Don.
Really?
You know, and because it would be certain scenes, I felt that focus I need. It would be too hard to come in and out and in and out and in and out.
Would you have to make a judgment on each scene? I've got to give the acting the priority here. I've got to give the directing the priority here. Would you, or did you just sort of play it as it?
I maybe tried to be strategic on certain days about that, like thinking, oh, this is going to be a heavier acting scene than this day, so I have to do this or that. But like I said, once I would show up on the set, the plan would go out the window. You know, when man, you want to make God laugh, make plans, you know, and it was like that every day. So I would have plans about how the day would go, but invariably I'd show up and something would, you know, there's the scene where I'm kind of playing for Frances and playing Blue and Green when she comes into the club.
That's right.
And we're playing the playback. And because they used a lot of atmosphere and smoked up the room that day, the fire alarm is going off in that scene, the smoke alarm is going off in that scene, and the fire department sirens you can hear in the distance coming because they're driving to the set to put out the fire that's not there that my special effects guy created with the smoke. And through that, I'm playing this ballad to her.
Oh,
so
my God.
There were things like that. It's funny looking back on it, but there were things like that that obviously I was pulling my hair out on the day that
but
would
thank
cause
God
me to lose weight.
That you're the director at that point, because if you're just the actor, you're like, this guy's got to get his act together.
Right.
This director has got
going
to
on, man?
Shut
I'll
this
be
thing
in my
down.
Trailer that I don't have because we can't afford trailers, but yeah. I'm going to be in that corner pouting. You know, so yeah, no, that those things like that happened a lot. But then a happy accident would happen in the same way that we always have happen on film. Something amazing would happen. A performer would come in and play, and you'd be like, oh my God.
I got the sense from the film that Miles saw his life in a completely different fashion than anyone else saw his life. Like looking at it from, and using the methods you did of time stretching and the way scenes would layer over each other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would be flashbacks, but other times the flashbacks would meld with the present. It's a visceral experience of a film.
And that's the hope. That's the challenge, and that's the hope, is that you don't come in and you're not trucking in all of your, well, this is now, I know what this is Ray, or this is Walk the Line, or this
right.
is any of those that, and not to disparage those, but to say, if you come in with feeling like that, it can feel like there's a bait and switch, I think. And that was a lot of the stuff that we were concerned about early, is that, you know, when I do an interview and somebody go biopic, and I go, well, it's not a biopic, and I get to the end of it, and at the end they go, so in this biopic, and I go, it doesn't. You know, you're fighting uphill against the preponderance of evidence that says if it's an historical figure in this sort of a thing, and it's a period that's why you're doing this, right? Why else would you do it?
Right.
That's what the conventional wisdom is.
I'm kind of amazed that you know, with the family and with the financing and everything, that that you were allowed to make something that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like your vision completely, right?
Like, I could never say to anyone that, well, this isn't actually what I intend. It's like, no, it's to the degrees that I was able to accomplish to the at the level that I wanted to, you know. Like, yeah, we were in low budget hell. There were things that I was like, man, I would love to have another bite at that apple. But I can't say that wasn't the apple that I was trying to bite. It was like,
right,
that's the apple I was trying to bite.
Do you remember your lowest point on the set? Was there a moment?
Oh, yeah. I remember looking at an assembly that, not the whole movie either because we're still shooting, but I'd say 4 weeks in, we shot 6 weeks. 4 weeks in, John sent me just a rough assembly that he'd done with everything up to that point. And it was debilitating. I literally crawled into the bed and went, well, how do I kill this? How can I? I don't think they'll let me just bury it. Maybe I'll just buy it. Maybe I'll just spend everything I have and I'll just buy the movie and just bury it.
Put it in your backyard.
Yeah, and just be like, oh, that was my student film and nobody ever saw it and I just bury it.
What is it about that first cut that's so, I mean, because that's not an uncommon story.
Right. You're right. And that's what I was told.
Did you just see all the flaws and all the faults?
That's all I could ever see. And to this day, I don't watch the movie when we go to screenings and you know, festivals and premieres and stuff like that, because it's still very hard for me to see past the things that I see that way.
Brings up a conversation about getting that close to your art and that close to something that you care about that much. And yeah, can you ever see it removed from your expectations?
I don't think so. I mean, there's a story that I think Jerry Lewis tells about he and Billy Wilder were friends, and late in Billy Wilder's life, he, you know, called Jerry Lewis over to the house, and Jerry Lewis comes to the front door, and Billy Wilder's like, come here, and he's like walking through his house, and he's like, come, he's like, he's got a big house, we're walking all through his house, and he goes and walks down the basement, he's like, come on, he's like, What are we doing? But he goes down the basement and turns on the light, and he's got this old editing equipment, an old reel-to-reel, and he turns on the projector, and they start watching, and he's like, what's going on? He goes, I think I figured it out. I think I finally got it. And it's, you know, Sunset Boulevard. And he'd recut it.
You're kidding me.
He's like, no, watch this scene. I think I got it. I think I figured it out. It's like, they won 4 Oscars. What are you talking about?
Is it impossible to not have an expectation or... Do you think about that, or are you able to let it go? And
I'll tell myself not to read stuff, and then I'll read stuff. I don't want to know what people think, but then I want to know. I'm like, I don't want to know what the Twitter world says about it, and I'll read all the tweets. You know, it's like, I hope I have more discipline than to put myself down that rabbit hole of my emotions bandying about from every time somebody likes it or hates it. You know what I mean? I think that I've made something that could potentially be polarizing. And I think that if people are not able to let go of their expectation, they're going to feel disappointed. I think people who are willing to go along with the ride might feel like it's just, boom, I love this, is great. And everything in between that. So, and I think they're all right, by the way. You know, it's like, I wanted to do a poster. I was saying, you know, the poster should come out. You know, A.O. Scott, mesmerizing, early Oscar contention. Boston Globe, what the fuck is this? You know, Detroit Press, this is a piece of shit. LA Times, amazing. You know, I think that every quote should be on the poster. I've never seen, I think that would be a great poster.
You know what?
And then the last quote being Miles Davis saying, so what?
So what?
I'm like, that would be a great poster.
Did you ever have an audience member in mind that you're making it for? Is it a musician? Is it you? Is it?
Yeah, I did. And there were many different
ones. Who were you making the film for?
I can maybe answer that about who I didn't want to make it for. I did not want to make it for the 2% of the population that really understands jazz and really understands what's going on in that music. I hope they come and I hope they love it and I hope they experience it too. And I think if they let their stuff go, they will have that experience with it. But I know there is a snobbery that happens with that kind of music. So I knew that there might be a problem with those guys. But then I'd, you know, sit and talk with Herbie, you know, and Herbie would say things to me like, I'd go, yeah, I don't know, I think people are going to maybe not like this, not like that. He goes, oh, it's great if they don't like it. He goes, that lasts longer. It's like, it's good if you've rubbed people the wrong way. It's good to do that with art and with music and with stuff about Miles. It's like, that's great. It's like, well, Herbie, if you're, you know, okay. And Vince Wilburn sees the movie and he's like, I love it. And Cheryl talks to me, his daughter, and she's like, you're right on time with this movie. You did the right thing. I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to listen to those guys. And yeah. No matter what happens as a result of the movie, which I can't control anyway, I'm going to always hopefully be able to go back and hear that. So, yeah, I had audience members in my head. But the best thing, somebody said to me, like, wow, I really want to listen to Bitches Brew now. Or, wow, I really want to go check out the Jack Johnson stuff. Or, man, I want to listen to those Copenhagen bootlegs now. I'm like, that to me was my highest goal for this movie.
You wanted to honor him by continuing that way of thinking and the approach.
And that approach to work. Yeah. That's what I want to do. I want to have musicians. I want to write music. I want to play with his art. I want to paint. I want to do all the things that he did because I feel like those are the marching orders that that man told everybody that he worked with to do. He was the guy who said, if I hear you playing your solo in your hotel room and you come down and do that, you're fired. He said to Herbie, I pay you to practice in front of people. I pay you to rehearse on stage.
Isn't that the most freeing thing? Isn't that what an artist wants to hear?
They all talk about it. Once they believed it, like I'm saying, my editors, once they were like, I think he's serious. Oh, then you just have so much fun. And there's something infectious happens in that where everyone feels like, oh, we could all play in the pool and all of us have the say here. And we all have something that's valid that we can contribute to this.
Well, it's not hard to draw an analogy to an actor who comes in on a set and the director says, I want to play here and I want to try what I want to see you practicing. I want to see you can fail here and yeah. You're protected.
Yeah.
Versus a director that has an agenda.
You say this, you do that.
That's right. Or really is waiting to see the performance he saw in his head.
Right.
Rather than being surprised.
Right. Right. Yeah.
How did directing this film, how did it inform you as an actor? What did it teach you about being an actor?
That's really a good question. How special that relationship is and how very often actors, because you can't. I mean, you don't really understand what it is that when that director is carving out that however much time he's spending to tell you specifically and really be all about you in that moment, how many other things, you know, are that building of that stuff that's back there in his head is sitting there too. Like, and as soon as you check that off, now you got to look at the purse and
that's
then you're
right.
Going to need to make sure this couch is right. And then you got to hear that sound cue. And is his name IE or is it EI? Every question is going to be asked to that person. So how special that time is when you have that with a director who gives you that. That is something that they're really...
Something to value.
That costs something. And that you should really honor that. Because I've been that actor at times who's been like, yeah, what? I know what we're doing. And it's like you don't think about the fact that's a very precious moment that person had to carve out for that. And
yeah.
It's really, you really should be in that process with that person at that time and really focus on that.
Yeah. Well, God, I could talk to you for hours about this. I think that you made a film that it begs to be watched a few times because there's so much information packed in there that the first time you're just sort of trying to hang on because
right.
it confounds your expectations.
Right.
But at the same time, it makes me very excited to see what you'll do next because now you've had this experience. And unlike your wife, I think you should do it again. I think you should dive deep into it as long as it doesn't kill you because really interesting things come out of that. And you know, where's the fun in being safe?
Exactly.
So I, you know, thank you for sharing it with me.
Oh, thank you, man.
Your experiences and I'm excited to see what you do next.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. We'll see.
Hey folks, that's our show for this time. Thanks for tuning in, and trust me when I say this,
You won't want to miss our next episode with actress, singer, and heart-on-sleeve wearer, Kristen Bell.
I really genuinely like to look for the good in people. It makes me a happier person. I really like to give people the benefit of the doubt because I also want them to give me the benefit of the doubt. And I really believe in how you act is sort of your karma.
In our conversation, Kristen opens up about her relationship with husband Dax Shepard, reveals the inner turmoil that has plagued her since childhood, and explains why being an actress has been a necessary part of her emotional well-being. It's a fascinating and heartfelt conversation with a woman who has a reputation for being extremely likable, even when she is doing very bad things. See you next time, Off Camera.